I was going to joke by saying I'm not going to talk about climate and capitalism. I'm going to lighten the mood by just talking about political repression. But Zelda's also... it's going to lead on nicely from Zelda's talk just then. I'm assuming there was some sort of acknowledgement at the start of this panel. I would like to add to that just by couching... whenever we talk about political repression and policing and the criminal justice system, we need to recognise that it's on the basis of over two centuries of genocidal violence experienced and survived by First Peoples throughout the country, and that all of the systems we're talking about, policing and the prison system, the criminal justice system, has been a core component of the colonial project in the country, and remains a core component of suppression. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the origins of that and our role in pushing back against legal political repression and the strategic elements of that. A large part of my activist sort of career over the last 30 years or so has been involvement in a global solidarity movement called Peace Brigades International, or PBI. I worked with them over many years in different components. PBI has been around for over 40 years. It was established in the late 70s, early 80s. Through the work of Latin American solidarity activists and anti-colonial activists in the Global South coming together and forming an international solidarity peace and human rights force or brigade. And PBI's primary modus operandi that's been developed very early on in the early 80s was to field teams of international volunteers, often for very long times, well over a decade, in areas of intense political repression. We've worked in Colombia, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, in Aceh in West Papua, in Indonesia and Sri Lanka, in several other countries as well. The primary work of PBI is to provide what's called protective accompaniment, specifically with activists, local activists, who are facing severe threats because of the work that they do, they're organising. They might be Indigenous land defenders, women's activists, they might be Indigenous leaders, lawyers taking human rights cases, organisers, unionists, a whole variety of activists, all of who face either the risk of assassination, death or disappearance or torture because of their work and the context in which they work. And PBI provides sometimes 24-hour accompaniment to those activists. We're going to meetings with them, going out to regions, travelling in vehicles with them through checkpoints, going to court, turning up to meetings or rallies or protests where they are, where they're speaking, and providing incredibly close quarter accompaniment with them so that it raised the cost of the state carrying out their threat of assassination or disappearance. But having an international volunteer with these activists means that it's less likely that the state will carry out their threat because it increases the cost of that, having an international volunteer, and the PBI volunteers act as literally the eyes and ears of the international community and backed up by a global solidarity network and the diplomatic network. So it's quite a sophisticated protective human rights protection strategy. One of the reasons I'm mentioning it is because over 40 years, no PBI volunteer has been killed doing this sort of work. And also, no activist that we've worked with has been killed or disappeared while under PBI's protective accompaniment. And that's extraordinary for a whole number of reasons, one of which it demonstrates how activists in facing these sort of conditions under extreme risk, where their families might receive threats, where their colleagues and other friends have been killed or disappeared, where they're withstanding sometimes decades of US-sponsored state terror, those movements and those groups and those activists have been able to continue using an array of strategies and tactics, including using international solidarity mechanisms and using tools such as PBI's protective accompaniment. And they've been able to continue their work. They've been able to maintain their groups and their organisations and continue. The other reason I mention it is because a lot of this the ideas, the tactics, the approaches, the organising philosophies, the practice principles we've applied in various ways to Melbourne Activist Legal Support. We use those sort of same sort of techniques when we're here in Melbourne doing at protests and seeing human rights abuses and seeing problems with policing and public order policing right here. We're using some of those same chain of command advocacy techniques, using a support network to back up our presence on the streets, using our direct presence as a deterrence, but also to enforce and assert our human rights concerns right throughout the chain of command, and therefore expose it and reinforce and reinvigorate existing accountabilities and human rights protections processes, which by themselves are not effective. But our presence on the ground can help reinforce them and make them more effective. The other reason I mentioned the start off with PBI as well is because over the 40 years, the many thousands of us that have worked with PBI have learnt an extraordinary amount from the activists who we've worked with. And PBI, you know, as I said, we stay for decades in a particular area. Volunteers have to stay for at least one year as a minimum in those areas and speak the local language. We've learnt as an organisation an extraordinary amount about political repression and about how movements withstand it, how they survive, how they keep going. There's an enormous amount to learn from activists from the global south, in Latin America, throughout Southeast Asia, throughout the Arabic countries, all of those countries that have experienced, and movements that have experienced deadly state repression and continue their work and their movement and their organising. I'm going to talk about some of those now because I think it's incredibly valuable and it needs to be part of our conversation, and it is part of our conversation in lots of ways. A book that's PBI has used over the years is called Affirmation and Resistance, The Community of Support, by these two Latin American activists, Carlos Bernstein and Francesc Riera. It was published in 1992, but it really captures a lot of the experience of Latin American activists through these decades of repression. And they talk about the importance of understanding the goals of repression, what's happening, because one of its impacts, of course, is just how confounding, I believe, confusing, overwhelming state repression can be for activists. As actors are continually trying to figure out at what point will our action, the protest that we're about to organise, or political action we're about to take, what will the consequences be? And when that becomes murky and grey, when we don't know what the response of the state will be, it becomes extraordinarily difficult to organise and mobilise and bring more people into the movement and expect them to also take risks. So that confounding, blurry nature, and what Zelda talked about, the insanity of it, is often deliberate. It's a deliberate strategy to confound our movements, to confound our ability to organise effectively by making us second guess everything that we do. One of the goals of the political repression that Carlos and Francesc talk about really clearly is to break the bonds of collectivity and solidarity, to fragment our ability to collectively organise, to disrupt our networks of support and solidarity. And by in doing so, transform the population, to one of acquiescence. The targeting of Blockade Australia, which we all should be really aware of, is similar in many ways to the targeting that XR experienced, Extinction Rebellion experienced years before. It's similar to the sort of targeting and policing that the Occupy movement in Australia and in other parts of the Western world also experienced, that coordinated, simultaneous crackdown and neutralising of the movement that was coordinated from all tiers of government and policing right around the world to break up and disrupt the ability of Occupy to continue its ability to hold public space. We've seen this time and time again, this developing approach of what the criminologists are essentially calling strategic incapacitation, that shift away from negotiated management models of policing to one of where the police are deliberately trying to neutralise, disrupt, destroy the ability of movements to continue their organising using a whole variety of relentlessly coordinated tactics. Just the severe volume of policing, having dedicated units, disruptive and preventative raids of organising hubs and activist centres and training centres. We've seen that grow substantially since the Occupy days. Over in the UK, XR organising hubs have been raided preemptively on quite a regular basis now. We've seen it over in WA. We saw it earlier on in around the G20 organising back in the 2006, but and the, around even around S11, but it's getting more and more frequent and prolific, that idea of police coming in and raiding organising hubs and disrupting preemptively. Preemptive arrests and anti-association measures, the whole variety have been growing, and police have been using them in increasingly sophisticated ways. The control of the media narrative, that preemptive demonisation, calling activists terrorists, criminals, public enemies, etc. That's incredibly common to repressive apparatuses around the world. That's again is to break the ability of the break the connection between the activist organisation and the general public, the general community. And we saw that in Sydney, where the community outrage was maximised by the politicians and the police, was used as a weapon. That community outrage about the tactic was weaponised by the police against Blockade Australia. In similar terms to the media narrative was weaponised against XR and Occupy and other movements that seek to disrupt public and hold public space. The other, of course, goal of repression is to establish impunity, and police and military forces and security forces in general do that very effectively. So police in Australia and in other parts of the world always use a mix of lawful and unlawful tactics when they control and contain in order to control and contain movements, and often the unlawful aspects of the policing will never be determined unless activists themselves go through the really long and arduous, incredibly costly efforts to bring cases to court or follow through complaints or take civil action. And that's incredibly difficult and only happens in rare cases, where we can push back against the extrajudicial policing that is so common just about at every protest. Mels is in quite a unique position as a standing legal observer, legal support organisation, in that we can monitor policing over long periods of time. And these are the sort of things that we have noticed, particularly since we were formed in the heady days during the Occupy movement in Melbourne, where we sort of saw the policing of the and how coordinated and sophisticated it was, and how effective it was. Occupy was pretty well smashed after a few short months, really, of trying to hold public space, only 7 days, really, of holding space in a coordinated way. And we saw how effective the policing was in disrupting Blockade Australia's work. And the other insight, I guess, from many activists in the Global South is that one of the things that's really critical is movements need to anticipate repression. It's going to happen. It's always going to happen. Any movement of any sort of worth that raises its heads above the parapets and seeks to disrupt or shift or tackle power is going to face some sort of repression. And that repression is quite sophisticated, so we need to anticipate that. Melbourne Active's legal support is just one example, just a small example of the recognition that activists groups need to develop really sophisticated and strong activist legal support structures if we're going to withstand the full might of the criminal justice system being weighing in upon us. So that that sort of movement infrastructure that we can bring to bear, street medics, the movement education and training resources that the Commons Library provides, the media and communication resources that are provided by 3CR radio and other community media systems, all those sort of movement infrastructure sources are incredibly valuable. And the unique part about all those is that they're cross-movement. That's another really important characteristic of movements that are able to withstand repression, is able to reach out beyond its milieu, its niche, and its issue to recognise, as Zelda was talking about, that our struggles are combined, united, we have common cause, we do need to work together, and we need to support each other across our movements. Activist legal support needs to be provided at every single point, from before arrest, in preparation, arrest, throughout the court process, and into the prison system. And that also needs to be cross-movement as well. We can't expect a single movement, a single group, after it's already been hammered by policing, to do all its own jail support, to do all its own court support. We need to weigh in and help each other. The sort of jail support, long-term court support that we saw after IMARC was a really good case where it was two years after 2019 for all the cases to be heard, and the IMARC court support, legal support system existed all that for that period of time. Totally unknown, totally outside the media, no fanfare or anything else, but that dogged behind the scenes work supporting activists who had been arrested at IMARC was critically important. Generally, activists and movements have a small number of responses to repression. One of those responses is to stop doing the work, stop being an activist. For many of us, we have a privilege to go and do another job or to follow another career, or for some we don't have that privilege, but that's an option, and that's often a response to this sort of policing. There's so many people after S11 and after Occupy and others who are no longer part of the movement, and that's really critical that as a movement we develop ways to support people who after these to withstand repression. Another response that's very common is to work clandestinely, to choose to work underground, to not do public stuff, not put your head in the public under the over the parapets. In our part of the world, that usually translates as just becoming an internet anonymous internet warrior. But generally, to stay out of the limelight, and that's a very common activist group response to repression. And unfortunately, all of us know that working clandestinely, it's very hard to organise strong movements and organise in the community to mobilise people if you're doing it in underground or clandestinely. But it's also a safety technique. So activists in zones of repression sometimes work clandestinely underground for periods of time, but they recognise that as soon as they have the political space, they need to work in the open again and work in the public and bring people together and mobilise strongly and assertively and openly. Another way that activists and the movement respond to repression throughout history in other parts of the world, and we're seeing it here as well, is to respond to the repression in ways that build the movement, in ways that make the movement stronger, and ways that make the repression of the state backfire on itself. And Zelda mentioned some of this before. We're seeing Blockade Australia do this sort of work already. And that's the idea that movements that can anticipate, work with, withstand repression, and can then use the repression to make the movement stronger. The irony about this, and the most important thing to realise about this, is that all those elements, all the things that do that, the movements that do that, that put in place the things that allow us to withstand repression, are also elements that make a movement more likely to be successful. Movements that are able to reach out broadly to other civil society sections, to other movements, to churches and unions and civil society groups, and draw in support, build support for its own, for its cause or its political objectives. Movements that can support and train and build leadership throughout the organisation, so that have multiple layers and support for leaders as they move up through the movements. So that when 20 or 30 leaders are picked off or have restrictive bail conditions, suddenly there's another 20 or 30 or 40 leaders to continue the organising and organise the next set of actions. Movements that can train and support new people coming into the movement, that can provide that sort of resourcing and support to allow people to step up gradually in their courage and conviction, and can also help people overcome fear. And movements that can help their members respond to and overcome fear are generally really strong. And that can be a whole range of things, but that expression of training and support is a really key element of that, of overcoming fear, to allow people to practice their responses to police, to arrest, to imprisonment, to all these sorts of things in a safe environment beforehand. Practice it, work through it, all those sorts of things. Are far more likely to withstand that sort of level of police repression when it actually happens on the streets and not get shocked by it. But also movements and groups that can really hold together and support each other and have strong support debriefing systems and are aware of those emotional responses, the anxiety, the fear that comes by facing police and political repression. There's probably lots of other ideas. I'm not going to talk through more, but that's that idea that movements can mobilize and grow stronger through with being able to withstand political repression. And I was in awe, and I think we all should be, of the activists up in Sydney who were dealing with both the operational security needs of knowing that all of their communications were being monitored by police at any point, they could be picked off and arrested, but also trying to mobilise numbers for a really assertive, staunch and courageous actions in the middle of the CBD against that and really vitriolic public condemnation and at all levels of government, from the police minister, the premier and the chief of police, all targeting them and demonising them. And then able to both assertively call for solidarity from a wide variety of civil society groups and continue to mobilise public gatherings and call out some ways of getting involved in the movement. So all of us should be really both in awe of and learning from the responses of Blockade Australia to that sort of policing